This is the Plant on the Line program here at thecommentary.ca. Mark McKinnon is the Middle East correspondent for the Globe and Mail. He's written a new book, The New Cold War, Revolutions, Rigged Elections, and Pipeline Politics in the Former Soviet Union. Distilling the politics and people of Eastern Europe is not an easy task, yet McKinnon does it with ease as he chronicles the democratic revolutions in Serbia, Georgia, Ukraine, and Kyrgyzstan, and the role both the United States and Russia have played throughout. Did the countries of the former Soviet Union get anything new with the fall of the Berlin Wall, or was it much of the same after the fall of communism? Mark McKinnon is a two-time winner of the National Newspaper Award and the former Moscow bureau chief for the Globe and Mail, where he's worked for nearly a decade. The New Cold War is published by Random House and retails for $34.95. Mark McKinnon joined me from Ottawa.
I'm pleased to welcome to the Plant on the Line program Mark McKinnon. Good morning, Mr. McKinnon.
Good morning, Jim.
Thanks for joining us. Boris Yeltsin was laid to rest last week. Talk to me about his impact and legacy on the current Russia, if you will.
It's a very mixed legacy, as we saw from the tributes that were coming out of Russia this week. My friends in Moscow that I've been communicating with in the last few days have been saying the line that one of the youth that stuck with me is that we'll raise a glass to Boris, but we'll also shake our heads at what he did wrong. What he means is they're going to toast the moment in 1991 when he stood on the tank and faced down the coup, bringing down the Soviet Union and launching Russia on this new course to democracy, to free markets and all of that, but also everything that since then, I mean, the form of democracy that he introduced Russians to was highly corrupt. The free market that many Russians got to know was one that made them poor. That's those images of bread lines that we all remember from the 1990s. And so, I mean, I think many Russians spit now when they say the word democracy or free markets, and that's part of his legacy as well. Not just that those glorious moments in 1991, but everything that he did since then that sort of set the stage for the Russia of today and the Putin and Putinism that we're dealing with now.
He did handpick Putin to be his successor, correct?
He did, and it was a very strange process that we don't know everything about yet. Putin came, really from nowhere. It was sort of a revolving door of prime ministers in the latter years of Yeltsin's rule. And in his memoirs, Yeltsin indicates that he chose Putin because he believed this man was loyal, and sort of hinting at what everyone believed to be the case, which was that he agreed to hand over the keys to the Kremlin to Putin and his cadre in exchange for immunity from prosecution from the alleged corruption that Yeltsin and his inner circle were involved in. Yeltsin never really commented very much on Putin and sort of what followed him, but we've seen some reports in the last few weeks from his confidant that he was actually quite distressed at the direction that Russia was heading under Putin, but couldn't say that anything about it because of the immunity deal that he'd struck.
What happened, though, at the end of the Cold War? I mean, there was this, I guess in the book or in some review I'd read, there was this romantic hope that liberal democracy would flourish in Soviet satellite states as it did in Czechoslovakia and Poland. What happened in Russia in particular?
Well, in Russia and across the, across the former Soviet Union, and in many ways, Yeltsin was a bit of an exception to this. Instead of getting the dissidents coming to power, like you did in Poland with Lech Walesa, like we saw in the Czech Republic first Czechoslovakia, then the Czech Republic with Václav Havel, you weren't seeing the sort of the storming of the palaces. It was much more sort of an inside job where the people that inherited power were sort of just trying on a new coat. You know, even Yeltsin, of course, came from the Communist Party apparatus. The people that went on to rule the states of Soviet Central Asia, that took over in Azerbaijan, in Georgia, in Ukraine, were all either one-time members of the Politburo or they were long-time apparatchiks. So it wasn't really a revolution in many ways. It was sort of some people who recognized the direction that the world was heading in at the time and kind of caught the wave. And deep down inside, I don't think these people knew or understood democracy very well.
Do you think democracy is not a good fit for that part of Eastern Europe, do you think?
There are a lot of people who would argue that, and especially a lot, the inhabitants of the current Kremlin would say, this democracy is a Western concept and it's not going to be the same in every place. You know, we need, what the system they've developed, they call, rather cynically, managed democracy. And by that they mean this is a system where you have the appearance of choice, you know, multiple parties on the ballots, many multiple candidates, but the Kremlin whittles down, you know, which parties are going to get media attention, which parties are going to get funding. So at the end of the day, you're choosing from sort of an authorized slate of candidates. It's not really a free democracy in the Western sense of the word. And they'll also point to the fact that Putin, for all the criticism from the West about his crackdown on the media, about his lack of tolerance for dissent, is overwhelmingly popular. No poll has ever put him below 70% support, and while that might seem incredible, in my own journeys through Russia, I, you know, outside of Moscow and St. Petersburg, which are sort of liberal centers in the vast Russian heartland, it was very difficult to find people who genuinely thought that Putin was taking the country down the wrong course. They generally agreed with his idea that stability was more important than freedom, that you know, getting their pension paid was more important than having a choice of newspapers.
And you were able to travel freely in Moscow or throughout Russia when you were Moscow bureau chief of the Globe?
Yeah, there's no restrictions anymore on foreign media in the region, and not in the entire region. There were problems in places like Central Asia and places like Uzbekistan. You'd certainly get the sense in Belarus that you were followed, and occasionally the people that you were speaking to would often have a harder time than you, the Western journalist. But no, there was no restrictions. There were no areas that I couldn't go to, with the exception of perhaps some very sensitive military sites.
And that's a sense you got traveling amongst the Russian people, that they like Putin a great deal?
Yeah, and I remember, you know, there's some very striking conversations I had with people who would say, you know, I would talk to them. I remember one of the big cases that unfolded and got Western concern while I was there was the jailing of Mikhail Khodorkovsky, this oligarch who had led the sort of the most open westernized company in Russia and was the country's richest man who'd begun dabbling in politics. So he got shut down by the Kremlin and jailed rather arbitrarily. You went across the country and you talked about stuff like this and you asked ordinary people about this case that was causing such concern in Washington. They'd say, you know, they would agree with Putin. They'd say, well, Khodorkovsky's a crook, just like your Enron. You know, he should be thrown in prison and his assets should be distributed amongst people. I mean, to go back to some of the opinion polls, even those done by, you know, westernized firms, they would come up with people, the nostalgia for the Soviet days increased in the last few years. It's not like, you know, the old timers are clinging to this ideal of what their youth was like. I mean, even among the youngest age groups, it's really people are looking back at the time of empire, the time of the Soviet era, and forgetting about the atrocities, forgetting about the terror, and just remembering the stability they had. And Putin gives them a taste of that without, you know, this sort of this quasi-authoritarianism he's developed is quite popular.
Does Putin, do you think, I'll rephrase it, does Putin affect the way that Russians perceive Americans, perceive the West?
Yeah, and I'm glad you asked that. I should add an important caveat to everything I just said there, and that's that the opinions that I was just referring to are obviously shaped by the fact that outside of Moscow and St. Petersburg, you're getting maybe four television channels, all of which are owned directly or indirectly by the Kremlin, and all of which are under tight state control. And the newspaper, you're probably just getting one, and it's probably the same newspaper you've always received, some, you know, a Pravda or a Komsomolska Pravda, some sort of newspaper that has, you know, has barely changed since the Soviet days. So, you know, while the debate, discussion, and opposition in Moscow and St. Petersburg, the cities that most Westerners visit, when you get out into kind of the Russian hinterland, you know, the support for Putin, it is somewhat manufactured, you could say, as is the sort of the hardening of attitudes to the West, the blaming of the West for everything that went wrong in the 1990s, the blaming of the West for the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, you know, is definitely shaped by the Kremlin.
Now, the West has come in with money, haven't they? The George Soros and this National Endowment for Democracy. You write about that in the book.
Yeah, and I mean, part of that stemmed from, you know, when I remember I was in Ukraine during the Orange Revolution, and I met a guy named Marko Markovich, who was working for one of these American-sponsored pro-democracy organizations, and I went to his office, which is festooned in orange, And we started chatting a bit, and I noticed there was a Croatian flag on his desk, and asked him about that, and it turned out that he was of mixed Croatian Serb descent, and his 4 years earlier had been on the streets helping bring down Slobodan Milosevic. And he kind of introduced me to this web of Serbs who had who worked for this organization called Otpor, which means resistance in Serbian, who had been traveling all over Western Europe, all over Eastern Europe, to places like Georgia, to Ukraine, to Belarus, and basically riling up the opposition, riling up the people, getting them into the streets against the sort of the old Soviet kind of rulers, the Soviet-style rulers is a better word for it. But they were doing so on the American dime, in the name of promoting democracy, but there were also American strategic interests that they were working for and towards.
And some of those involved energy and oil?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it, when you don't want to say it's all about oil because that would be a bit of an exaggeration, but certainly when it got down to examining why the American concern for democracy was so much greater in Georgia, where there was a flawed election in 2003, but which got sort of mixed reviews from the monitors saying, you know, it was better than the last one, but there were some problems, and neighboring Azerbaijan, which also went through a much more deeply flawed election in 2003, you know, where the president who inherited power from his father put riot police in the streets to quell dissidents. When you look at sort of the American actions and their support for these NGOs in these two countries, there's a stark difference between the amount of support they poured into the opposition in Georgia in 2003 to a time when Edward Shevardnadze, the president, was sort of turning back towards Moscow, and the lack of interest in the process in Azerbaijan, where Ilham Aliyev was playing along and allowing British Petroleum and the American oil firms basically have their way with the country. Now, if you look at the key pipeline that cuts across South Caucasus through Azerbaijan, Georgia, and Turkey, which is really has been identified by Dick Cheney as an essential energy corridor for the United States, and it's a little cynical to say that was the only reason that America was so deeply involved, but it certainly played a large role. The people who were involved in the Rose Revolution, the Americans who were there, acknowledged that.
I want to get back to Russian, what we're talking about a second ago, but I want to just, because I brought up this energy, and you mentioned Dick Cheney, and so on. How does the war on terror affect the politics in Eastern Europe?
I mean, one of the things of the downsides of this campaign and its focus on sort of battling radical Islam is that in the early stages of it, America, extracted some concessions from Putin, namely bases in Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan, from which they could take part in the war in Afghanistan. And in exchange for that, they basically gave Putin a carte blanche domestically, which is why, for years there wasn't a lot of focus on what Putin was doing at home. The crackdown on dissent wasn't really a concern in the West until very, very recently. And it was all under the cover of the war on terrorism because Putin and Bush decided to stand together for a while there and portray themselves as allies because of the Russians were dealing with the Chechen issue, and America was more concerned about with Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda, and Iraq than it was with Russia. I think now that sort of that Russia's, I think at the time America didn't mind because Russia was perceived as weak. Now that Russia's back on its feet and growling and playing this energy card as it has so often in the past, it's becoming much more of a concern. You're seeing kind of much more adversarial statements coming out of both Washington and Moscow in the last few days, especially.
The personal relationship between Putin and Bush, do we underestimate that? Do you think does that matter how two people get along?
I think, at the start, they were, they were keen to portray this friendship. We all remember, I think, that when they were talking about looking into each other's eyes and
looking into each other's soul or something like that.
Exactly, into each other's souls and all that. I think on a more important level, what happened in 2000, kind of to me, when the new Cold War began, was when you had at almost the same time an ex-KGB colonel come to the presidency in Russia, and the son of a former CIA boss come to power in Washington, and the two sides, and the people that worked around them as well, just instantly recognized the old enemy across the sea. And went back to sort of this adversarial, not in the open yet, but when you talk to people at the National Endowment for Democracy, when you talk to people in the Kremlin, they acknowledge that from the get-go, they knew they didn't like each other, and there was going to be a problem eventually.
I'm interested, and I go back to this question of Russians. accepting democracy, former communists accepting democracy, or I want to look into the hearts and minds, I guess, of the people there. Do you think, I mean, I'm thinking of Putin and how he's dealt with political critics and opponents, and you know, we've seen disappearances and murder in some cases, poisonings and so on. Do Russians, do you think, is it a rejection of democracy, or have they not really had it that they don't know what they're missing?
I think it's probably more the latter. I mean, you know, if you go back you know, through the centuries, Russians have never had much say in how they're governed, whether it was under the Tsars, whether it was under the communists. With the exception of the Yeltsin years, for all their faults, it was a really a remarkable and unique time in Russian history. And now, you know, the average Russian, when you talk to them about the changes under Putin, they recognize this. This is back to the way it always was, and they don't honestly expect to have much say over things. And in the Yeltsin years, you know, there were free elections and all that, but many people didn't believe, for instance, their vote was really being counted, or that it was being counted fairly, and people thought that it was just under the control of capitalists, the famous oligarchs. So I think it is that they've never really had a situation where they got to understand their vote, that their voice mattered. And so they're not terribly bothered by the things that Westerners think they should be bothered about. As long as, like I said, their situation is stabilizing, and Putin has done that. The economy under Putin has grown tremendously. People's lives are improving. That's why he remains so popular.
Can we bridge the gap, though, between, let's say, Western ideals and Putin's current Russia? I mean, are we on the brink of some new, as you, in the title of your book, a new Cold War, or one that's perhaps a little warmer?
I think a lot will depend. And in many ways, this book, I was intending it to be sort of a guide to the 2008 presidential elections in Russia, because I think it's going to be a really remarkable time. You know, as far as anyone can predict, there's about three possible courses. And the first is that Vladimir Putin finds a way of modifying the Constitution to stay for a third term in office, or elsewise modifies the balance of powers, so, you know, makes the prime minister perhaps the most important job and slides over to that instead of the presidency. You know, some form of clinging to power. The second option is sort of that he chooses a successor, probably from his inner circle of, which include a lot of ex-KGB agents like himself, and they find a way to sort of gently transfer power through this managed democracy system with no real election, and it just kind of put on the window display of holding a vote, but really just passing it from one agent to another. And the third option is the one that the Western-backed opposition is plotting, which is to try and bring the Orange Revolution to Moscow, to try and get Russians out into the street and to demand the things that people in Ukraine have stood up for, that people in Georgia have stood up for. It's a tough thing to do in Russia, especially given the size of the country, and especially since the Kremlin knows it's coming. They've analyzed what happened in Georgia, what happened in Ukraine especially, and have recognized the power that the groups funded by National Endowment for Democracy, that the Soros Foundation have, and they're really curtailing and clamping down on these groups, cutting off their space to breathe. So, I mean, I can't predict which way this will go, but I think the answer to your question is coming in how many years' time. What kind of Russia are we going to be staring at after those elections will be crucial to whether this Cold War is, you know, a chill for the Putin era, or whether it's going to be sort of a long, deep period of animosity.
We've read in your reporting in the Globe and Mail about Canada's role in the Orange Revolution in the Ukraine. You mentioned that bringing the Orange Revolution to Russia. Do you think Canada, what's Canada's place in all of this, do you think?
Canada's place was, you know, by and large is not nearly as active, with the exception of Ukraine. I think Ukraine was a special case for Canada, in that there were people inside the Canadian government, people working in the Canadian embassy in Kyiv, and the vast Ukrainian diaspora who understood what was coming and understood the importance of that to Ukraine. Canada has a special place in Ukraine because, of course, it was the first country to recognize Ukraine's independence from the Soviet Union back in 1991. And a lot of Ukrainians, every Ukrainian is aware of that. Every Ukrainian has a relative in Canada. So the connection was just was a really thick one. So I think this was, you know, in many ways a one-off event where Canada, with feeling a perhaps an irrational but a strong tie to Ukraine, decided to maybe step out of its normal diplomatic role. I mean, it didn't play nearly as advanced a role in Georgia or in Belarus. Diplomats in Russia, to my knowledge, are not involved in the sort of stuff that Andrew Robbins was involved in Kyiv. So I think that might just be a special case.
You are now the Middle East correspondent for the Globe and Mail. How does that work in terms of just logistics? Do you spend most of your time in the Middle East?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I started writing this book towards the end of my time in Russia, my 3 years in Russia, and basically since then, every time I had a vacation or a long weekend, I would just fly back to Kyiv or to Moscow or to Tbilisi or Belgrade to just continue the reporting and writing of this. So, but no, especially now that it's finished, I'm full-time Middle East these days.
And you live where in the Middle East?
I live in Jerusalem.
And do you have your family there, or are you alone? Or?
No, I'm there with my wife.
And how does she, is she a journalist as well?
Yes, she is.
And this obviously is an important time to be in the Middle East. Do you see yourself writing a book about that experience later on, perhaps?
That's a tough one. I mean, the Middle East is such a well-covered area in some ways. I would like to. I know that I have publishers that have asked me about that already. I'm only 2 years into my time there, so what kind of grand conclusions I would draw, what kind of direction the book would take, I'm not there yet, but it's certainly a possibility.
And this book, the reaction to this book thus far, it's only been out, I guess, a couple weeks or so?
Yeah, just over a week now, yeah.
What's the reaction been?
It's an interesting mix. I mean, I've had people say that this book has made them deeply afraid of Russia, and that wasn't my intention. I've had others, some of the printed reviews that have come out have said that I let Russia off a little bit easy here because a good chunk of the book is dedicated to exploring the role of the sort of American-funded democracy groups and asking the question of whether or not what they're doing is right or justified. In my profession, that's not a bad thing. In our profession, to try and walk a balanced line. I think if you read this book objectively, you get to the conclusion that I'm not a big fan of where Putin is taking the Soviet Union, where he's taking Russia. But the first reviews, I think, start coming out tomorrow, so I'm sort of anxiously awaiting them.
It's a prescient book and an important one, and congratulations on writing it, and good luck with it, Mark.
Well, I really appreciate your time, and thanks so much.